Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So I mentioned in a previous episode that one of the things I used to enjoy doing was visiting border communities in Israel. I explained before that growing up in Ireland, I, you know, would spend time looking at Google Maps and reading the news in Israel. I was a teenager at this point in time. And I was always fascinated that when you zoomed in on the map, you'd see, of course, to state the obvious, wherever you have a border, like the blue line between Israel and Lebanon, you've got communities that are just right up on the border. And I think the borders of Israel really capture my imagination because they represent these fault lines, not just between countries, but really between ideologies and often states that are at a state of formal war, like between Israel and Lebanon. So it was with a lot of excitement when I moved to Israel, and after we got a car, which it's really hard to reach some of these places if you don't have a car. I would say almost impossible. That we began actually seeing some of these places that I'd read about, just seen in the maps, and the terrain is very different. There's something very deceptive about a map, especially when you're not looking at the 3D. The topography, because what looks like a very, very close community on the map, especially the border with Lebanon, the ground in these, it's a really fascinating area of Israel, where you've got just these, it's very deceptive. It's beautiful. I would say the same thing about the Gaza border. Some of the most beautiful, calm parts of the country happen to be, you just look at Google Maps and you say, oh my gosh, this is where I am. I'm literally right next to the border. Word of caution, of course, for anyone thinking about doing this, please check the news first and don't get too close to the border. You can get close enough, but there is certainly, you know, a distance that is not advisable to approach any international border. Anyway, so I went to Metula a few times in the context of these visits. We did, I think, two trips. Metula is a little town right up there on the border with Lebanon. It's surrounded on all sides. At this point in time, I was doing my YouTube channel, and when I was producing my YouTube channel, I always, on these trips, carried around my camcorder, the Canon XA40. Got a pretty decent zoom lens. So during the trip, I think I made a few videos documenting my trip to Metula, and as you do when you're creating YouTube content, you shoot some B-roll. B-roll, for those who haven't come across the term, it's just those kind of cutaway shots you see in videos. So I was shooting some, we went down to one of the nature trails right by the border, and I shot a clip, just not really anything too extraordinary, just like panning across. You have the blue line, the UN demarcates the border with a blue line, and I just shot a pretty nondescript shot, just like a little pan shot left to right. So I get back to Jerusalem, I take the SD card out of the camera, I do a quick glance, which is always what I like to do, just kind of before editing, I just go through everything I've shot, and I look at that clip, and I say, oh my gosh, I did not see that. On the Lebanese side of the border, just behind the blue barrels, I see a guy, a civilian, I think, not in army fatigues, with a big gun. So I'm guessing this is like some, I don't know, Hezbollah guy right at the border. And I'll never forget seeing that on my camera roll, because I definitely did not see that with my eye. And it made me wonder about these areas right by the border, like Metula. Periodically, they flare up, but for the vast majority of time, you have this like really intensive presence between the two sides, but nothing happens. Now, I have to ask a really grim question, and it's one of those morbid questions that... That I feel like I have to ask at some point. When I looked at this footage, it really hit home to me. But when you're in some of these border adjacent areas, anyone on either side of the border can take a pop shot, and you're finished. But that doesn't happen very frequently. In fact, it happens remarkably rarely, such that if it did, it might trigger another war. And I guess that's the answer to my question, which is that why doesn't? In these areas that are potentially explosive, and you can extrapolate from this to any border area or any very high tension border, where you've got communities living within, let's say, firing range of the other. And my question is really, when you see these things with your naked eye, or almost in my case with my naked eye, you see that what you don't see is very surface thin. You don't see if I didn't see that, there's probably a whole bunch of things I didn't see on either side. So these borders that are often very beautiful from a surface level standpoint are actually highly militarized in practice. But for, again, the majority of time, it seems that all you actually have going on is a very high concentration of forces on both sides who are just watching each other very, very closely day after day. And that's really what I'd love to get into, Herman and Corn. It's an intriguing concept for me that you have this kind of constant standoff that rarely happens. And that's really what I'd like to really talk about, is this concept of deterrence, because we've talked in Israel about the lessons learned from October 7th. We've talked about the high-tech border. But what ultimately, I think, stops a Lebanese Hezbollah fighter, and I'm not going to draw an equivalence between Israel here because it's not a fair comparison. Hezbollah is, to my mind, and I think to those of a lot of people, a terrorist organization, and Israel's a regular army. So I'm expressing it specifically in this way for that reason. What stops a Hezbollah person from shooting at the Israeli side is not the existence of some ultra sophisticated Israeli tech, maybe partially, but more so because of deterrence and the fact that he knows that if he did that would start to escalate to a whole war. So it would be good to explore the concept of deterrence as it exists, because it seems to be the only thing frequently that's actually holding what might be very explosive parts of the world, especially all the borders here in Israel, keeping them at least under control as much as sophisticated border control mechanisms and security is. Let's talk about deterrence in the context of volatile border regions. Over to you, Herman and Corin.
You ever get that feeling that you are being watched? Not just a passing glance from a stranger on the street, but a focused, intentional gaze from someone whose entire job is to keep an eye on you. It is a heavy sensation, right? It is that prickle on the back of your neck that tells you that you are no longer just an individual moving through space, but a data point in someone else's tactical assessment. Well, today we are talking about what happens when that feeling isn't just a fleeting moment of paranoia, but a permanent, structural part of your daily life. We are looking at the thin, invisible lines that separate total peace from absolute chaos.
And specifically, what happens when that gaze is the only thing standing between a quiet afternoon and a full-scale conflict. I am Herman Poppleberry, and this is My Weird Prompts. We have got a really fascinating one today that touches on something very close to home for us here in Jerusalem. Our housemate Daniel sent us some thoughts after one of his trips up north to the border communities. It is February 7th, 2026, and as we sit here, the landscape of the north has changed so much over the last 2 years. Daniel's prompt really captures the essence of that shift.
Yeah, Daniel was telling us about his time in Matula. For those who do not know, Matula is this beautiful, historic little town at the very northern tip of Israel. It was founded in 1896 with the help of Baron Edmund de Rothschild, and it has this incredible rustic charm with stone houses and fruit orchards. But geographically, it is a total anomaly. It is a finger of land poking up into Lebanon, surrounded by the border on three sides, the north, the east, and the west. It is the definition of a frontline community. Daniel was there with his camera, doing some filming for his YouTube channel, and he had this moment that really stuck with him. He was looking through a high-powered zoom lens at the Lebanese side of the border, just behind the blue barrels that marked the United Nations line, and he saw a man, a civilian-looking guy, but with a very large gun, just standing there, looking back.
It is such a visceral image.
You are looking through a lens, trying to capture the beauty of the landscape, the rolling hills of the Galilee and the mountains of southern Lebanon, and suddenly you are staring at the reality of the conflict. But what Daniel found most striking was not just the presence of the guy with the gun. It was the fact that, for the most part, nothing was happening. The town was calm. The air was still. This prompt really gets into the heart of deterrence. How does this massive concentration of force and constant surveillance actually lead to a weird, fragile kind of stability? Why does that guy with the gun not pull the trigger? And why does the soldier on the other side not fire first?
It is a paradox, is it not? You would think that having two heavily armed groups staring at each other from 50 yards away would be a recipe for constant violence. But in these border regions, you often find this deceptive, almost heavy calm. I want to dig into that. Herman, you've been looking into the theory of deterrence lately. How do we define it in a place like Mechila versus, say, the old Cold War nuclear standoff that we all grew up hearing about?
That is a great place to start because the scale is so different, but the logic is identical. In the classic sense, deterrence is about preventing an action by making the cost of that action so high that the other side decides it is not worth it. During the Cold War, it was mutually assured destruction. If you launch, we launch, and everyone dies. At the border level, like in Mechila or along the Blue Line, which is the withdrawal line established by the United Nations in the year 2000, it is a bit more granular. We call this cross-border deterrence or tactical deterrence. It is the idea that if a single shot is fired, the response will be so overwhelming and so immediate that the person holding the gun decides to keep the safety on. It is a constant, silent negotiation.
But Daniel's point was that he did not even see the guy with his naked eye. He only saw him through the lens. That means there is this layer of invisibility to the threat. How does deterrence work when the threat is hidden, or at least not always obvious? I mean, if I do not see the gun, am I still deterred?
That is actually a key part of the psychological mechanism. Deterrence is not just about the person you can see, it is about the person you assume is there. It is the psychological weight of the unknown. On both sides of that border, there are sensors, cameras, and soldiers in camouflaged positions. The guy Daniel saw was likely part of a deliberate show of presence, what military analysts call showing the flag. But the real deterrence comes from the thousands of other eyes you cannot see. It creates this environment where every move is calculated because you know you are being analyzed in real time by thermal sensors, acoustic detectors, and artificial intelligence algorithms that can spot a change in the grass from 2 miles away.
I am curious about the psychological impact on the people living there. We have talked about this before, how humans are remarkably good at normalizing the extreme. If you live in Mechila, you know that there are people with rockets and rifles just over the fence. You know they are watching you through binoculars while you hang your laundry. How does that shift from a terrifying reality to just the background noise of your life?
It is a phenomenon called habituation. Your brain literally cannot stay at a high state of alarm forever. It is too taxing on the nervous system, so you develop this weird dual consciousness. On one level, you are checking the news and making sure the bomb shelter is stocked with water and canned goods. On the other level, you are complaining about the price of tomatoes or the fact that the neighbor's dog won't stop barking at 3 in the morning. But what is interesting is how the deterrence itself facilitates that normalcy. The civilians feel safe enough to go about their lives because they trust that the balance of power is holding. They trust that the other side is just as afraid of the consequences as they are. It is a peace built on a foundation of mutual fear.
You mentioned trust, but it is not trust in the sense of friendship or a shared vision for the future. It is trust in the other side's rationality. You are betting your life on the idea that the person with the gun wants to stay alive as much as you do. You are assuming they are a rational actor who has done the math and realized that pulling the trigger results in their own destruction.
Exactly. It is a cold, calculated kind of trust. It is a belief in the efficacy of your own side's threat. But here is where it gets really interesting and where we saw things change so drastically over the last few years. For a long time, there was this concept in Israel called the conception. It was the idea that our technology, our high-tech walls, and our overwhelming military superiority had created a permanent state of deterrence. We thought the other side was so deterred, so beaten down by the cost of previous conflicts, that they would not even dream of a major escalation. We thought the sensors could replace the souls.
Right. And we saw how that ended on October 7th, 2023. That was a total catastrophic collapse of deterrence. It showed that deterrence is not a permanent achievement or a trophy you put on a shelf. It is more like a living thing that you have to feed and maintain every single day. If the other side starts to believe that your will to respond has weakened, or that they have found a technical or psychological way around your response, the deterrence evaporates in an instant.
And that is why the situation Daniel described in Matula is so tense now, in early 2026. The rules of the game changed. Before 2023, the deterrence was based on a certain level of predictability and a reliance on remote technology. Now, it is much more about active high-friction presence. You cannot just rely on a smart fence and some remote-controlled machine gun stations. You need boots on the ground. You need that guy with the gun to know that if he raises it, there is a sniper already looking at him through a scope, and that sniper is a human being making a human decision.
This brings up the high-tech versus low-tech debate that Daniel mentioned. We have spent billions of dollars on these incredible border systems. We have artificial intelligence that can identify the difference between a wild boar and a human insurgent from miles away in total darkness. We have underground sensors to detect the vibration of a shovel digging a tunnel. But at the end of the day, Daniel's most impactful moment was seeing a human being with a rifle. Does the high-tech stuff actually deter, or does it just provide a false sense of security for the side that has it?
It is a bit of both, Korn. The high-tech systems are what we call force multipliers. They allow a smaller number of people to watch a much larger area. They give you early warning, which is the most precious commodity in a conflict. But technology does not have a soul, and more importantly, it does not have a reputation. Deterrence is built on reputation. A sensor can tell you someone is crossing, but it is the human response, the history of what happens after that sensor trips, that makes the intruder regret it. The tech is the eyes, but the human is the teeth. If you have eyes but no teeth, you are not deterring anyone. You are just filming your own defeat.
I think there is a misconception that more technology always equals more security. But sometimes, technology can actually create gaps. If you rely too much on cameras, you might stop sending patrols. If you stop sending patrols, you lose the feel for the ground. You lose the smell of the air, the subtle changes in the landscape that a camera might miss. You lose that face-to-face communication of threat that Daniel witnessed. There is something uniquely communicative about two humans staring at each other. It is a very old, very primal form of negotiation that predates written language.
That is a great point. It is almost like a silent conversation. I see you, you see me. I know what you can do, you know what I can do. Let us both go home for dinner tonight. When you remove the human element, you turn the border into a technical problem for the other side to solve. They start looking for blind spots in the cameras or ways to jam the sensors with electronic warfare. They treat the border like a puzzle rather than a person, and you can solve a puzzle. It is much harder to solve a person who is actively trying to stop you and who can adapt in real time.
Let us talk about the second order effects of this. When you have this high intensity deterrence in a place like Matula, it does not just affect the soldiers. It affects the economy, the architecture, the very way the land is used. If you go to these border towns, the houses are built with reinforced concrete. The windows are often smaller on the side facing the border, or they have heavy steel shutters. The playgrounds have bomb shelters that look like giant caterpillars or ladybugs to make them less scary for the kids. It is a surreal blend of domestic life and military fortification.
It is the architecture of anxiety. Even in the calmest times, the landscape is screaming at you that danger is close. Every bus stop is a reinforced concrete box. Every new house must have a mamad, which is a fortified security room with a heavy steel door and a gas-tight window, and that has a long-term impact on a community. It filters who chooses to live there. You get a very specific kind of person in these places. People who are resilient, maybe a bit stubborn, and very deeply connected to the land. But it also means that the moment deterrence fails, the collapse is total. We saw this with the mass evacuations of the North in 2024 and 2025. When people stop believing in the deterrence, the town ceases to function as a home and becomes just a military outpost.
That is a really important point. Deterrence is the foundation of civilian life in those areas. Without it, you cannot have schools, you cannot have farms, you cannot have a local grocery store. So the military is not just defending a line on a map, they are defending the possibility of a normal life. But here is the rub. Does the very act of defending that life through massive militarization eventually destroy the thing you are trying to protect? Does Metula become so militarized that it is no longer a town, but a garrison?
That is the ultimate challenge for any border community. You want to be a town that happens to be on the border, not a base that happens to have civilians, and that balance is incredibly hard to strike. If you make it too much like a fortress, people do not want to live there because it feels like a prison. If you do not make it enough like a fortress, it is too dangerous for families. What we are seeing now is a move toward what people call integrated defense. It is trying to weave the security into the fabric of the town so it is less intrusive but more effective. Think of it like a smart home, but for an entire village.
I want to go back to the guy Daniel saw through the lens. Think about that guy's perspective for a second. He is standing there with his gun, looking at a prosperous Israeli town. He sees people drinking coffee on their balconies. He sees kids playing on those caterpillar-shaped slides. From his perspective, the deterrence is working on him. He has been told, or he knows from experience, that if he causes trouble, his own village, his own family, will pay a massive price. He is looking at the target, but he is also looking at his own potential destruction.
Exactly. Deterrence is a mirror. It has to reflect back on both sides. On the Lebanese side, the deterrence is not just about the Israeli army, it is about the memory of past conflicts, like the 2006 Lebanon War. It is about the destruction of infrastructure and the displacement of hundreds of thousands of people. The man with the gun is a part of that cycle. He is there to show strength, to show that his side is not afraid, but he is also a hostage to the situation. If his leaders decide to break the deterrence, he is the first one in the line of fire. He is a pawn in a very large, very dangerous game of chess.
This leads to the concept of the gray zone. Since full-scale war is so devastating because of deterrence, groups like Hezbollah or various militias try to find ways to act just below the threshold of war. They do things that are provocative, but not quite enough to trigger the big response. They might point a laser at a soldier, or throw stones, or move a tent a few yards over the line. They are constantly testing the edges of the deterrence. They are asking, is this the line? Is this? How about now? It is like a child testing a parent's patience, but with rocket launchers.
And that is the most exhausting part for the defenders. You have to decide every single day which provocations to ignore and which ones to meet with force. If you react too strongly to a small thing, you might start a war you do not want. If you do not react at all, you are signaling that your deterrence is weakening, and the other side will take another yard and then another. It is a high-stakes game of chicken that never ends. It is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It requires an incredible amount of discipline and emotional control from the 18 and 19-year-old soldiers standing on those lines.
You know, we have been talking about the Israel-Lebanon border because that is where Daniel was, but this applies to so many places around the globe. The demilitarized zone between North and South Korea is the classic example. You have millions of soldiers, thousands of pieces of artillery, and nuclear weapons all held in check by the same psychological mechanism. Or the border between India and Pakistan in the Kashmir region. These are places where the calm is entirely manufactured by the threat of violence. It is a synthetic peace.
It is a grim way to maintain peace, is it not? It is not the peace of friendship or mutual understanding or shared values. It is the peace of the stalemate. But in a world where interests often clash and ideologies are in direct opposition, sometimes a stalemate is the best you can hope for. The goal of deterrence is not to solve the conflict. It is to manage it. It is to buy time for the politicians and the diplomats to hopefully, eventually, find a better way. It is a holding action for humanity.
But does that time ever actually get used for diplomacy? Or does the stalemate just become the new status quo that everyone gets used to? In many of these places, the diplomats have not made a real breakthrough in decades. The soldiers are doing their job so well that the leaders do not feel the urgent pressure to change anything. The deterrence becomes a crutch that allows the underlying conflict to rot and fester.
That is a huge, valid criticism of deterrence theory. It can lead to stagnation. If the cost of the status quo is bearable, why take the political risk of trying to change it? Why offer a compromise that might make you look weak? You end up with these frozen conflicts that can stay frozen for generations. But as we saw in 2023, frozen does not mean dead. Things can thaw very quickly and very violently. A frozen conflict is just a volcano that has not erupted lately.
Let us talk about the role of international players in this. Daniel mentioned the blue barrels, which are the United Nations markers. You have the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, or UNIFIL, up there. Their job is to be the referee. But in a high-intensity deterrence environment, what can a referee actually do? They do not have the power to deter either side. They are not a military threat to anyone.
The role of international observers is really interesting, and often misunderstood. They are not there to stop a war through force. They do not have the mandate or the equipment for that. They are there to provide a neutral account of what is happening. They are meant to prevent misunderstandings. If a shot is fired, they can communicate between the sides and say, hey, it was an accident, or it was a rogue soldier, do not escalate. They act as a buffer and a communication channel. But their effectiveness depends entirely on both sides wanting to avoid war. If one side decides the deterrence is over, the observers are basically just spectators to the catastrophe. They are the witnesses, not the police.
It is like having a mall security guard at a standoff between two SWAT teams. They can report what they see, they can take notes, but they are not going to stop the bullets once they start flying. Still, having that third party can be a face-saving measure. It allows a side to back down without looking like they are surrendering to the enemy. They can say they are complying with international requests or following United Nations Resolution 1701. It gives them a political exit ramp.
Exactly. It is all part of the theater of deterrence. And I use the word theater not to mean it is fake, but to mean that it is a performance. Both sides are performing their strength and their resolve for the benefit of the other. The guy with the gun Daniel saw was performing. The Israeli drone hovering overhead was performing. The goal of the performance is to convince the audience, the other side, that the play should not turn into a tragedy. It is a performance where the best possible outcome is that the curtain never falls.
So, what are the practical takeaways for someone listening to this? Most of our listeners are not living on a volatile border, but the principles of deterrence show up in all sorts of places. We see it in cybersecurity, where companies try to deter hackers by making the effort of a breach more expensive than the potential gain. We see it in law enforcement, in international trade, even in office politics sometimes.
One big takeaway is that deterrence is about perception, not just reality. It does not matter how strong you actually are if the other side does not perceive you as strong and willing to act. In any situation where you are trying to prevent a negative action, you have to communicate clearly. Ambiguity is the enemy of deterrence. If the rules are fuzzy, people will push them. If the consequences are uncertain, people will gamble. You have to be clear about where the line is and what happens if it is crossed.
Another takeaway is the fragility of it. You can never take a stable situation for granted. Whether it is a border, or a business relationship, or a social contract, if you stop maintaining the balance, it will eventually tip. You have to be proactive. You have to be like those border communities, aware of the threat but focused on maintaining the normalcy. You have to invest in the relationship, even if that relationship is one of mutual deterrence.
And I think the final takeaway is the human element. No matter how much technology we throw at a problem, no matter how many sensors and AI bots we deploy, the core of conflict and its prevention is human psychology. We are moved by fear, by pride, by the desire to protect our homes and our children. If you want to understand why a border is calm, you have to understand the people on both sides of it. You have to look through the lens like Daniel did and see the person on the other side. You have to recognize their humanity even if you are pointing a gun at it.
It is a sobering thought. That calm we see on the map, those quiet lines in the news reports, are actually the result of thousands of individual choices made every day by people with guns and people with cameras. It is a very human construction. It is a fragile, beautiful, terrifying achievement.
It really is. And it makes you appreciate the quiet moments even more. When you are in a place like Matula and it is a sunny afternoon and you can hear the birds and the wind in the apple orchards, you realize that silence is an achievement. It is not an absence of noise. It is the result of a very loud, very intense standoff that everyone has agreed to keep quiet for one more day. That silence is the sound of deterrence working.
Well, this has been a deep dive. I think it has really changed how I look at those border maps. It is not just a line. It is a living, breathing tension. It is a conversation that never stops.
Absolutely. And it is a reminder that we live in a world where that tension is the baseline for so many people. We should never forget the weight of that. We should never take our own peace for granted.
Definitely. We want to thank Daniel for sending in that prompt. It is always great to get a perspective from someone who has actually been on the ground and felt that atmosphere. It really brings the theory to life when you can picture that guy with the gun through the zoom lens.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. And to everyone listening, if you found this discussion interesting, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It genuinely helps other people find the show and helps us keep these conversations going. We are trying to reach as many curious minds as possible.
It really does help. You can find all our past episodes, including our deep dives into technology, psychology, and society, on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We have over 500 episodes in the archive now, so if you are new to the show, there is plenty to explore.
We love hearing from you guys, so if you have a topic you want us to tackle, or just some thoughts on today's episode, get in touch through the contact form on the website. We read every single message.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks for joining us today.
Stay curious, and we will talk to you in the next one. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.